Welcome to the fifth episode of Discord, a first-person critique talk show where two architects with distinct takes on how to do good architecture come together and criticize each other's work in a constructive manner. I'm Ainsley Johnson, and I'll be the host of this episode. I'm an interdisciplinary designer, curator, editor, and educator based in Winnipeg, Canada. The show's premise is based on the epistemic socio-cognitive conflict theory. It postulates that there is a strong correlation between engaging in direct constructive criticism around a specific question and the improvement of one's knowledge of both the topic of the question and of the format of the discussion. In other words, openly and frankly discussing each other's work leads to better projects and to a healthier architectural culture. This episode features a discussion between Sol Camacho of Radar from Brazil and Ambra Fabi from Piovani Fabi, based in Belgium and Italy. I'm finding the current status of criticism in architecture to be most exciting outside of the realm of the purely intellectual, and so I look for it in different forms and where it's revealed, usually in subversive ways, as is the nature of critique. I want to introduce lichens as critical architecture. Humor me, what is critique without some creativity and wit? First, in Michael K. Hay's Positioning of Critical Architecture Between Two Poles of Culture and Form, and as Resistant and Oppositional, he claims that criticism, then, I quote, as activity and knowledge, should be openly critical as well. Lichens are hybrid beings, simultaneously two things at once, and sometimes more than two. They are a symbiotic union of fungi and algae or bacteria. Merlin Sheldrake, mycologist and author of Entangled Life, writes that, I quote, within lichens, branches of the tree of life that had been diverging for hundreds of millions of years were doing something entirely unexpected, converging. He continues, in the wake of the dual hypothesis, evolution could no longer be thought of solely in terms of competition and conflict. Lichens had become a type case of inter-kingdom collaboration. The fungal component protects the photosynthetic partner, making them one of the most resilient species on Earth, able to withstand decades without water, even in the vacuum of space, rehydrating from dormancy with a single drop. Given the format of this podcast, it's perhaps too easy to say that critique is dialogue, is friction, an investment in the exchange, where work done now might only be rehydrated in a future, different context. But I'm doing it anyways. Polarity, in this case, is hope for longevity. The oldest living lichen is about 9,000 years old, witness to a time before cities and agriculture. Lichens have the ability to grow on almost any stable surface, including wood, stone, and earth, as well as concrete, glass, and metal. Sheldrake describes the process of lichens mining minerals from a rock, I quote, in a two-fold process known as weathering. First, they physically break up surfaces by the force of their growth. Second, they deploy an arsenal of powerful acids and mineral-binding compounds to dissolve and digest the rock. To criticize means to call into crisis. I'm sure many listeners are familiar with this quote from Roland Barthes' Criticism and Truth. The presence of lichen is a signifier of crisis. Sheldrake continues, lichen's ability to weather makes them a geological force, yet they do more than dissolve the physical features of the world. When lichens die and decompose, they give rise to the first soils in new ecosystems. In our contemporary crisis, as glaciers retreat, sea levels rise, trash amalgamates, lichens are the first to signal change, and they are the first new life of the future environment. Interdisciplinary writer, educator, researcher, and many other things, Shannon Mattern wrote the essay, Graphic Formalism, Lichen Elegy, in 2020, that observe lichens reinscripting granite headstones in a cemetery in upstate New York. In observing the lichen's growth patterns on names, dates, ornaments, and other embellishments, she says, even without human intervention, the natural world leaves ubiquitous traces that resemble writing, and which we are often then prompted to, in quotes, read. And continues, script lichen, graphis scripta, have spore-producing structures, lyrillae, that look like scribbles too. Their inscriptions deconstruct graphic form, turning words and numbers into language mutations of human and ecological entanglements. There are about 20,000 known species of lichen, but it is estimated to be more like 250,000 possible hybrids. Only about 1/8 of lichenous articulations is available to us. In their hybridity and their active but slow process of deconstruction and rebirth, maybe lichens are a critical architecture of a system takeover. Despite its small scale, I might dare to project ecological mutations of language embossed on stone to disrupt the record of all of history. I'm positioning critique outside of language alone, an exclusionary system to begin with, by borrowing mycological translations. Criticism can be an environment. As lichen grows, at the same time it weathers, a geological force, continually undermining the substrate to which it adheres. Projects in between collaboration and conflict, like this one, construct critique as a hybrid material form, weathering standards and foundationally changing the systems it's built upon. A crack in the rock, and new life. Isn't that the whole point? There are two basic rules to the discussion. Both participants should focus on the overall question of what could good architecture be? Each participant has to send the other three elements prior to the discussion: a built project, an unbuilt project, and a text of their own authorship. And now, the discord.
It's great to meet you. I know we are meant to discord, but I really like your work. And I was looking at it, and it's really nice to talk to you.
And Yami, I'm discovering your work. And what I find fascinating is that, it's very much rooted into this South American, Brazilian culture, architectural culture, but also culture in itself. And that both projects, the project of the pavilion and the project of the stadium, that deal with this idea of architectural patrimony, but also they have a very strong sense of collectivity.
Yes, so
that's in a way, I think they're a very interesting topic to tackle. I think in any case during this conversation,
I agree. I was loving the drawings and the models of the velodrome, because at the beginning of the Pacaembu is a built project from the 40s, so actually it's partially built, then obsolete, and then partially rebuilt by your project. But the when we thought of it, when we were first invited to do it, I was thinking of occupying this bleacher seats very much like you have them occupied, and it was like inviting this idea of like the city coming into the stadium, which is partially the idea. The fact is that calcio, football, soccer in English, but el futebol has changed a lot as a sport. I mean, it's not like it's not that the building has become obsolete. It's that the dynamic of the sport has changed. Today, the sport is a mass media business, which was not in the 30s when it was planned. And so the fact that the stadium became obsolete is obviously, because all buildings need to accompany the social and cultural changes. But in the case of soccer, especially, it was like huge changes. You know, the stadiums that are now being built have 60,000 people, 70,000 people, and they need to have the right lighting for the TV and for the streaming and for the, and the, I mean, it's another animal. And so the idea was from the beginning to bring the city in, keep the heart of the soccer, because of course that wouldn't be removed, but really kind of invade it more, like in a different way. And I think we managed a little bit, but in a very conservative way, to be honest, because we could go further. We could use the bleachers. We could have more of this possibility of a bleacher park, I mean, there's a limit to what we could propose and what could be accepted, because it's a building that is in the heart and soul and gut of so many people that we had to always go very slowly. And so when I saw your drawings, I was like, yes, that's exactly what, you know, like occupying more the bleachers and sitting in as almost as a... I mean, we managed to do it to leave the bleachers without seats in the historical portion. But I could almost see those collages that you do happening, those bleachers. It's a nice way to use something. Yeah.
I was wondering because, I mean, of course, there is this part of restoration or refurbishment of this, you know, with this historical stadium. You said it's from the 40s.
And
30s, yeah, okay. So, but it's somehow in your drawings, no? It seems like the project is much bigger.
I love this.
Yeah, the running track.
Yeah.
So it seems like that the project is much bigger. You see that there are lots of other sports facilities coming, but also other public possibilities, like I could see a market, I could see little other things happening. Yeah, that's in a way, and then just for understanding better the project, is it the project now phase one, or is it what's the story behind, how do you relate the drawings, which are this much bigger and quite impressive set of equipments is done at the moment?
It's like a first stage. The thing is, first, one of the main ideas of bringing it back, let's say, I'm always very cautious of saying bringing it back, because it never went away. I mean, it has always been used. Mm-hmm. But I guess trying to connect it to today's contemporary context, I guess that's what it is. Sometimes when we say reactivate or refurbish something that is active, actually, I mean, even though the amount of activity is much more reduced than originally used, especially because of the soccer. But to be honest, the other part of the complex, because it's not a soccer stadium, it's a sports complex that has tennis courts and swimming pool and poly sport like basketball and volley. So it has many other things that was active in some way. So we're kind of not reactivating. I think we are connecting it to the contemporary context. I feel like in that way, and saying in the contemporary context is to be able to reach more people. I guess very very little. It was not used to its potential, let's say. But one of the main reasons is because there has been an image imprinted in the city that it's only a soccer stadium, and very few people knew that it has an Olympic swimming pool. I mean, these are huge dimensions. These are not like a little, you know, like an Olympic swimming pool and these tennis courts that are like gorgeous and like quite extraordinary in the context. I mean, there are not many covered tennis courts, not only private, but public. This is a public building open to the public. And so the fact that this exists, it was little known. So the idea in this stage, as we are working with the project in 2019, we start, is trying to connect its ground floor as much as possible to the city, let's say. And although it's very intelligently laid out within the valley, so that's why it gains kind of like, that's why the bleacher seats are sitting in the, like on the topography. It is, I mean, it is elegantly greatly situated, but then it's also easy, difficult to arrive, let's say. I mean, difficult compared to other places, like you need to walk from a street that is coming down. And so it's not obvious connection. So we were really trying to bring, like, I always say that it's like trying a rug, like bringing the city like a rug into the complex, let's say. And the idea, some of the references even that you have in your text of pavilions were some of the ideas that we had as references of places of use, places of celebration, because at the end, this complex is about events, whether they are public, whether they're private, whether they're rock and roll, whether they are swimming, whether they, it's a place for events. And it could be the everyday event, like, you know, just you come in, you swim and you go by. Or the extraordinary event where you have 25,000 people looking at, watching. But it's meant to be for events because it's full of bleachers. I mean, it's bleachers, bleachers, bleachers. So you're always thinking of a pool and people surrounding it, and the tennis and people surrounding it, and the soccer and people surrounding it. So it's a place that is meant to have people. And the idea to have people nowadays all the time, because soccer is only, you have 25,000 people come in, 25,000 people come out, and the rest of the week people forget about the place. And so if we could bring more people in more schedules, in more times of the day, is the intention. Of course, that's our architectural intention, which is something to be debated with the public sector, the private sector, the you know, the investors. I mean, so many realities.
And then also maybe there is also the question, because when you talk about sport facilities, there are a lot of regulations that are the size of I mean, already the security, but also the size of the fields. In a way, there is very little freedom in it. And if you put this beside the fact that you, in a way, you have been working on a monument, no? Maybe what I'm curious to hear from you, what has been the space of freedom? And because in a way, the project looks very subtle and very delicate in an object which is very, in a way, monumental, which is the beauty of the project, I find. But so, I mean, and maybe it's also the question that we have to ask ourselves today in a context where we have to do more and more projects starting from the existing, no? So what is good architecture in a context that exists already? And how much isn't a good architecture the one that imposes itself, or the one which is also able to exist and reveal the places which are already there, the qualities of what is there? So maybe I was curious to hear about that.
Yes, I was looking at your plan of this, and the first thing that came into my mind is that it wouldn't be allowed to put the sports if they're not north south, for example, right? I mean, that's a rule, or you know, a norm, or whatever. But it's, of course, it's more playful if you can change some of the dimensions. I mean, it's very famous that Lina Bobardi in the Sesc Pompeia, she did non-professional dimensions so that it never became competition. It was always leisure, right? And which was not our case at all. I mean, we had like, well, it's not our case, but at the same time, it's a continuous debate because the soccer field, first of all, there are many official dimensions. I mean, whatever, when I arrived to the project, I thought that official dimension is this. And then you discover that official is a very blurry word. And what is official dimensions? And then the running track around the soccer it's also not official to the rules of the Athletic Brazilian Association today, but it was in 1940s. And so there were people that said, you know, you have to bring it to the athletic standards. And then there were people that, no, you have to leave the memory. And then there were, so you have all these possibilities of you know how to work with this, and always many views on, are we doing this for competition standards or like for official standards, or are we doing this for leisure? And our approach as architects, we were trying as much as possible to bring it to a leisure side, because the city needs so much of this kind of generosity. You know, a public place that has a pool and a tennis court and a field that you could have other people. The city is thirsty for this kind of thing. So if we could have more of this, like almost like a park, but then we had to also be responsible with the idea that it's not. I mean, it's not a park. It's not a CESC. There's no answer. We were debating all the time what to do, what not to do, and the freedom. What you're saying at the end is we keep the sizes of what we had, even if they are not official today. Just as the we reinvented the running track, to be honest, because there was nothing left, but the tennis is there and the pool is there, and we kind of rethink a bit of its surroundings so that it feels more of a leisure, although you are in this more frozen measurements, you know. It's an ongoing conversation.
No, it's interesting what you say, because in the case of the Vigorelli, I mean, the Vigorelli velodrome.
Tell me a bit about the velodrome.
Yeah, it was one of our first competitions. It was 2014, if I remember well, and it was. Actually, the velodrome was a building from the beginning of the 20th century, maybe the 1910, if I remember well. It was a building which was hosting this wooden structure, which was from fascist time, was moved from Rome to Milan. Anyhow, the whole story, but the story went that the size of this track, this wooden track, was not fitting anymore the Olympic standards, so... The competition, in a way, was about what to do with this building, how to include sport, how to include public, private, what to do with this track, which is historical, but at the same time, nobody can use anymore.
It's the same conversation.
Yeah, it's very funny. And in our case, we had to propose also an economical system of functioning, and... we took the direction of going completely public, to say we open up we take out the track so that the building can just be open on the side. There are the round part, the short sides, which can become really like gates that can be accessible, and the tribune part is just a place where you host shops, which allow to the building to survive. And then all the rest is happening on our new roof, under the new roof on the outside. And so it becomes a place for invention of a sports on wheels. So all kind of sports on wheels, which can be official, unofficial. And so we started to
With
invent.
this.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the roof.
So
The
the
roof.
structure exists. The structure of like the this exists.
So the structure, so the project was in a way became, we just took out all the infill and became just these bones, just a structural part. And so that is the existing structure, the historical structure. So we just rebuilt it and we just opened it up. And then in the we added this new roof on the outside. And under this roof, this new public space, with all these activities and spaces for learning to bike for kids, skate parks, rollerblade, I mean, all kind of activities which are in a way linked to the question of wheels. And we had a lot of fun also trying to connect this structure with the bike paths of the city. So we tried to, in a
Like
way, to make that the bike paths would pass
goes
through.
in,
And
yeah.
then they kind of mix for a moment with the official tracks and then they go out. So we imagine a lot of stories with it, but what happened? The reason why we lost was that in the end, the city decided to go for a total private solution where they closed completely the place and they made, in a way, a commercial mall in it. So it was totally another idea of what. Public architecture could be. So for us, in that case, good architecture was a civic tool, no? Was trying to open up, to become public, to give possibilities to the people through very simple actions like
Yes.
stripping out a building,
Yeah.
adding a new roof, adding public space.
It's great to hear this because I want to talk a little bit about freedom in the sense of that we're talking about the official measurements of sports, but then I want to talk a little bit about this freedom that you're putting in terms of activities and possibilities, which is something that we really wanted to insert, like this leisure and civicness and just come in. That is I mean, it kind of fills my heart with happiness 7 years into the project to come in one day and see people running and people sitting and people. It's not yet fully finished, so but people are really kind of using it. But so this idea that I want to connect with the idea of freedom and the last thing that you said about public and private, this has been the driver of the conversation in the Pacaembu case because and it has been such a tough thing to navigate. And I still think that in the balance of things, I think we've managed to do what I think, and you coincide that architecture could be like this tool for community and collectivity. The stadium, the complex, the sports complex is public. It belongs to the city. But the city, with all the things that I've told, it's obsolete, it's not being used, it's very costly. Soccer is a business and rents the stadiums. And so the clubs today, like the Corinthians and the whatever, they have their own stadiums with gazillion dollars and gazillion different things that they need, and so they were not renting that place, and so the it's very expensive for the city. And the first is that first conversation: does the city have to have revenue from its own infrastructure? No, it doesn't have to have revenue, but we live in in an economy that cannot support this kind of thing. And so why don't we take the best about public and private partnerships? And so this is how it arrives. So it's a private, the private sector that says, okay, I'll take care of your stadium. I'll manage it. I'll keep it public, but I am allowed to explore it commercially. And to be honest, I think just as architects, we need to work more with existing buildings. I think so approach different ideas. Public and private need to, I think that's the best, need to approach each other. And the public, at least here, everywhere in the world today, it's very polarized. So the public approaches the private already with a tough face, and the private approaches the public already with a tough face. So, you know, you're sitting in the middle of the public and the private. And for me, it was very clear that we could perfectly, you know, bring the money of an investor that wants to, you know, they were even thinking what to do. So they wanted to insert a hotel and a convention center. And then the private says, we want to keep the doors open. And in our imagination, I mean, just like your drawings, and that's something that we can do, that we can costurage, we can
weave.
We weave together. And for me, it was very clear from the beginning, but I think everyone around the process has learned that that is possible only years into the project. Like the private sector, although they were, I mean, they knew they have a monument, a public monument, so they didn't come in not knowing that. But I think they have even become confident, more confident in understanding that it's okay to be public. I mean, it's great to be public. I mean, you open the door for more people that come in, and that can obviously be a place of consumption at the end. But and the public have learned to, oh, we can work with someone that has money and that has a for-profit business. And I, for me, it's, I don't think it's 100% attained, but there is kind of like a little bit of espoir, like
you mean it was a pedagogical project for them?
What?
There was a process of learning. It was pedagogical.
A process of learning, but less for the architects and more for, yeah, for everyone else, that we can all use the same space. So it's okay. And I think we've kind of managed, and we meaning everyone that is involved, not in a perfect way, but I think it is public and it is private and it's all together at the same time.
Talking about private and public, how, I mean, if you talk about, I don't know, the Bobardi Foundation, and I talk about the small pavilions that we did in the parks in Brussels. I mean, in the case of the pavilions in Brussels, it was about the, in a way, public institution which manages the park, which has to, in a way, private
concessions, right?
Yeah, to kind of work on this, to take care of this pavilion. So maybe it's more public than private, but let's say that there was a part of a private coming into a public realm. And in that case, I think it was a very good learning process for everybody, in the sense that I'm now maybe not talking about the people involved, but about how the way the parks are used, that really changed a lot the way, just to insert a small structure of that kind, I think in Brazil, in South America, in Italy, it's very normal to have this kind of outdoor structures. But when you go in northern part of the countries, northern Europe, Brussels, even though the public spaces are very interesting and beautiful in a way, some are monumental, some are historical, but in the end, there is not the culture of using the parks. No? So there is not the culture of being in a public space, because in a way everything is interiorized. And that's, yeah, the more you go north and the more things are interiorized. And then the interesting thing was how to adding in a way these sort of small rooms, small outdoor rooms, very open, at the same time privately managed, so there was a place for buying things, but at the same time it was a really a place which was giving another center to the parks, and at the same time framing the outdoor space in another way, you know, so that you would
No.
enter inside and you would be able to look at the park differently under another angle. And that's also what happened in your pavilion
In the Lina,
in the
but
Casa de Vidro.
I'm curious to hear a little bit more about because we could talk about this idea of public and private and infinitely, your pavilions are a great place to speak about that is a bit blurry. How can we it's obviously privately managed, the commercial, you have a drink or whatever, but it lives together with I mean, you can come with your picnic thing, with your own things and sit down, or you can come and buy a coffee. I mean, so it's a place of consumption together by a place of not necessarily consumption, which in the case of the stadium could be, you know, you can come swim and go out and not buy a single thing, or now you can come and buy and have water and a coffee and you know, like, so we don't need to do either consumption or non-consumption. We can, if we weave them together, is something that happens. But in the case of your pavilions, it's elegantly done, and is quite polemic here in Brazil. The big park Ibirapuera now is privately managed, a bit like the Pacaembu, but in a different way, because I think it's different an infrastructure than a park. And how do you regulate or who manages your pavilions so that it, why is this client and not McDonald's, for example, that could put, you know, like, how do you can't regulate, you know, what we think is good taste or branding, or how do you keep it from why doesn't Burger King can have the same pavilion as your beautiful coffee pavilion?
But yeah, it was an interesting experiment in that on that level, because so this Brussels Environment, which is this institution which manages the park, which say it's a public institution, they asked us to make these pavilions, which are mounted and dismounted every year. So they are mounted since, you know, in Brussels it's a relatively cold environment, so they are on from May to October,
October.
beginning of October. And so in a way you need a lot of, on one side the project has to be imagined as something that you can mount and dismount, so that's in a way how it's done. And at the same time it has to be very in a way pragmatically designed for the people who take care of it. And the people who take care of it, they reply to a public call. And at the moment where this project started, we the this Brussels Environment asked for kind of ecological take on the way of use of managing the bar. So it's a small group of people, like almost like a family group, which has a bio shop and can offer. It's a small bio shop in Brussels, and they can offer food starting from there, and they cook it. So it's very, and since until then, until now, they always renewed the contract with them. So it started with the idea of also offering opportunities to local situations,
Smaller.
and that's how it's kept at the moment.
It's an amazing example, because outside the stadium, the Pacaembu, there's a big praça. I mean, they call it praça, we call it praça, but it's a big parking lot. And we have thought of it with inside the office with other people on how to take on that, right? Because it's almost like if we had worked on half the body and the other half of the body is like still, you know, in the 20th century. And the idea of there is a response to activating it with small spaces of consumption. You could have nothing, but there is an acceptance from the public in general. If you could have where to buy a water, where to sit down and have a coffee, or you know, but there is such a fright that this might become, you know, the pavilion of Starbucks, the pavilion of McDonald's, the pavilion, like that. I think there's like, then there's nothing, you know, like, and how to control the branding in the cities. I mean, that is a whole thing. Sao Paulo has this thing called Cidade Limpa, so clean city. And they took away every sign in the city in the 90s or 80s. I think it was in the 90s. And so different than Mexico City. I'm from Mexico City, and you have, you know, Coca-Cola, Kleenex. I mean, like everything in your face. And so in the city here, you don't see big signs. But when it comes to little pavilions, that could start to happen, because nowadays there are many ways, there are many loopholes in that law. So I saw your pavilions. I'm like, there is a formula there that could be, you know, that could be brought to other contexts. That is quite interesting to understand.
It's true that probably to work around a stadium, you deal with such a kind of almost like a church. I mean, it in Italy but in Brazil too.
Yeah.
Stadium is almost like soccer is like a religion. So it's a center of gravity where there is so much pressure that in a way, it's another story than parks, which are maybe not very much in the center of the attention because we are not used to live in it. So I think that here we are more. If I look, for instance, in situations. Like where stations are redone or these public spaces where the crowd is there. And of course, the interest of brands to inhabit, it's very big.
Yes.
It's true that so far the parks in Brussels, so there are our pavilions and then there are a couple of other realities, which are all in a way somehow collective based. So collective, bio, self-managed. And I think it's very much already because the reality of the city, Brussels, is a relatively small city.
Mm-hmm.
The parks, the managing of the parks is done by also people which are kind of... So the decisions happen among few people.
Yes.
And there is not such a social pressure as this crazy place where all the ages or the social classes and cultures come together.
Yes.
No, that's
and there's an expectation of what this place should be from so many people that, to be honest, and as is the reality, the architectural voice is a tool, but we're obviously not the main drivers of the project when it's such a project, I think in general. But I think we've actually quite managed to have a louder voice than I thought we would have. because you can imagine it belongs to the city, it belongs to the state, because it's listed as a monument in many. It belongs to the Green Secretary, the Secretary of Environment. It belongs to the municipality. It belongs to the sports ministry. It belongs to now to the concessionaire. It belongs. And so it belongs to so many people that sometimes bringing some architectural ideas and just placing people to speak about space and color and material and delicate decisions in a table with so many voices, it was never easy. And so so actually I think there has been some learning from everyone that architecture has emerged more than expected, less than in your renderings, but but more than expected. But let's go to the pavilion, to the pavilions and the idea of the scale that is quite nice, like the exterior and the interior that you said a lot about Brussels. In Brazil, the best place is open covered. So I mean, your pavilions are exactly something that could.
And like your pavilion as well. No, for us, I mean, in a way, the only idea of these pavilions is a relatively simple one. It's a perimeter, very simple. It's a roof. In a way, it's an architecture that can be appropriated at any moment in any ways, and its simplicity allows that. No, the fact that that would be maybe more designed, that would have provoked in a way fear of appropriation. Whereas this simplicity allows many kind of situations to happen inside, beyond the managing of the coffee shop inside.
Yes.
And
yes.
And that's very much also an idea that for us it's important in what we do in our offices. The idea of an architecture that, I mean, the good architecture, since you have to talk about it, it's about becoming a frame to be appropriated and lived in many levels and to enhance a lot of levels of imagination.
I was going to ask you to talk a little bit more about that, because I feel like, I mean, I looked at your website, also learning about your practice, that I didn't know how you can see that it's almost like an exercise inside of a larger exercise. So I mean, the idea of the sim, you have like this lamp and like that you had in other projects. And so it looks like this part of something larger.
It's true that there are many elements which are coming back again and again. Maybe the first one is the idea of working with the archetypical, with simple forms, the half circle, the square. I mean, simple, very, in a way, recognizable shapes. And then there are all these elements, maybe also the idea that always a project deals with the larger context, the parks, Brussels, or the landscape, or I mean, a cultural context, but then also it reflects like human scale by adding this pole, but also the chairs, the smaller lamps. So in a way, the architecture, even though maybe it's small, no, we made many of these pavilions, which are probably, yeah, for us, they're really a laboratory for imagining architecture, because there are nor buildings, nor furnitures, they are an intermediate scale, but at the same time, it allows us to deal with the, yeah, with the scale of the landscape, with the scale of the people. Is it neutral enough to allow possibilities? And so, yeah, then there is the moon coming back and back, this sign, which is at the same time an object which is defining the architecture itself, but also talking to the larger context. So the idea of collectivity is not only being a form which allows to appropriate, but also to talk on a larger level of the society. So you can see it and think and have built your own relationship with it. And
I love that idea. The pavilions as a typology, after Casa de Vidro, after I immersed into some research on glass because of the glass house, but also on the idea of pavilion as a typology, and there are these perfect devices that you you have a lot of flexibility for less compromise, let's say. When we were doing the pavilion for Casa de Vidro, there was like the, also this fright. There's always like miedo, peur, like you know, doing something at Lina Bobardi's house, you know, like, and it's like it's temporary.
What an
It's
amazing
temporary.
context.
But it came about, and it's a story that it's not written and not in the drawing, is that we were going to do a concert for fundraising in the I'll tell it very quickly, in the institution. And then the organizers were going to build like a plastic tent, you know, like a wedding plastic tent for to receive it for one day, and that's it. And so that was it. And that didn't bother anyone. You know, like a plastic tent with plastic windows, because it's one day, you know. And it really bothered me. Like, I was like, how can we put a plastic tent and have Maria Bethânia, which is like this amazing voice, you know, the soul of a whole generation, singing inside the plastic tent. And so the proposal to the board was this idea that we could build something that would not only last, it was the same cost than the plastic tent, if we could build something that could last 3 months and do more activities. So that's how I was kind of able to put the idea forward. I'm like, we'll do it, and it's more sustainable. It makes more sense, and that's how it came about. And of course, we had to do it without tearing any tree, and in relationship to the house. And I had like, you know, a week to design that, because, you know, otherwise a plastic tent was an easier option. And then we dismounted it and mounted it for the next summer. So a bit of like
That's
did it.
interesting. And is it one, I mean, just is it one piece, or is it it comes
It's
together in many
the
pieces?
it's two pieces in the roof, and then the rest is more pieces, like in CLT.
Yeah, I was wondering about the project, because it's very, I mean, it's an incredible place to make a project, I mean, I find the pavilion very beautiful, and it's incredible how it works. In straight building in a way of Lina Bobardi, but on one side I can imagine that you say, okay, that's I mean a garden context. I try to make a natural shape. I can imagine that, but at the same time it also relates to certain very Brazilian forms, no, which are present in architecture. In architecture, if you talk about even the window, the
Oscar, and
Sescovitelli, but also the Niemeyer, Burle Marx. I mean, in a way, there is a lot to refer to. So, I mean, yeah, how do you see in the project? Is it the result of the context itself, or is it the context? It's a larger cultural context.
To be honest, it would be too much to say that there was, you know, so much reflection into. I think it was in the back of my head, you know, it comes kind of like with you, but it was what we could fit, like, without tearing any trees. And obviously there's a say, but there's a hand, but it's almost like it was born from what we could do, and then it turned out that it had that language. So you never know what comes first.
It strangely fit extremely well,
Yes,
and in the pictures you almost don't understand that it's a, in a way there's something, okay, there is this form, and maybe the form in another context you would relate to some other kind of Japanese architecture, but here it's Brazil, and it takes somehow a bigger span of time, and it's a bit timeless because of that, and that's very interesting. So temporary
No, and
at the same time a bit timeless in the way it relates to form and space and and
I
so on.
was curious to see and invite other architects to do that pavilion the next summer and not to have a cliche summer pavilion, but it turned out such a good idea. I mean, you invite other people and have that, you make it last 3 times. So we said, 3 times. So three years mounted and dismounted. Because I'm sure there's other answers to that space, but it was definitely interesting. I think we're running out of time. That's why we kind of went down, because otherwise we'd have more conversation.
To the ground with the conversation, but
Yeah.
let's finish it there and let's meet maybe somewhere else soon.
Definitely, definitely.
I don't know if you want to, and there's I'm not going to tell you stop, stop, stop. If there's something you still want to say, it's perfectly
No, I
fine.
guess we were kind of
Trying
moving
to wrap
towards what
up.
you're trying to wrap up, and I think there's but really, I was fascinated with the idea that we had like these two larger
Me too.
infrastructures, and then the idea of the pavilion, and we can deal with we can deal with different scales, like the exercise, or we can test
Doesn't
ideas
matter.
for the stadium with a pavilion.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's interesting how, yeah, there are these topics of collectivity, of culture, like just a co collective norm culture for everybody, but also architectural culture. I mean, I was very fascinated by the link, yeah, with these two scales, these two projects, how they could enter in dialogue together.
That was a
The idea.
somehow crazy serendipity that you were
Yeah.
merged into for
Yes.
this format.
The idea of the pavilion for Lina, then to be able to have it was the party and everything, but it was also to bring people. Now, when we're talking about public and private, it's inside a private house. I mean, but it was the idea to bring other people that are non-architects also, because it's almost like an architecture place. Only architects go, and the artists. And we were able to bring a yoga session and drawing sessions and like other people to approach them to this very privileged place. Because obviously the house is a monument, and it's very you don't want to change it, but there are a certain amount of events that you can do inside the house. And so the idea of a temporary pavilion is almost like you could have a little bit of freedom inside a house that already brings a little bit of freedom, but bring other publics and approach other non-architectural instructed people.
It becomes a platform for other activities to happen in the place, no? And
Yeah.
at the same time, it also gives another point of view to the house. It adds
Yeah.
a weight, no? And so you can look at the house from the pavilion, and it gives an it frames it also differently, which is very nice, I find,
Yeah.
from the pictures.
Yeah. No, and because I'm thinking of this because your pavilions in the park, you're not talking about architecture with anyone, but anyone in the park will sit down there and know there's architecture. It doesn't
Everybody
have
now
to be in your
does
face.
the everybody in Brussels knows about the pavilions. They know the pavilions, they don't know they've been drawn by architects. And
Exactly.
if I say
That's
I'm the
nice.
architect of the pavilions, they're like, wow.
Yeah.
It's
But
incredible.
that's nice,
But at the
though.
same time, it doesn't matter. It's
Exactly.
the most
That's
important
nice that
thing.
they live
Yeah,
beyond
they're places
beyond
which are
the
used and lived.
Yes, I agree. I like that idea very much. Yeah.